why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the management of KUCI or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show, go to KUCI.org.
Good morning and welcome to the September 21st, 2011 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at KUCI.org and always available via podcast. I'm your host, Marie Stone. This is Writers on Writing. We are dedicated to the art and business of books. Each and every week, we are here with authors, poets, agents, giving you the latest and most up-to-date information on the publishing world. Today, we are not only doing fiction, we're doing quintessentially American fiction, with some emphasis placed on American this morning. It's my pleasure to welcome Tom Perotta back to the show, and coming up in the second half hour, Jane Mendelsohn will be here with her latest novel, American Music. Tom Perotta is the author of six works of fiction, including The Wishbones and Joe College. His novels Election and Little Children were made into acclaimed and award-winning movies. He was on with Barbara and me a few years ago with The Obstinance Teacher, and I've been sitting behind this microphone ever since, anxiously awaiting the next, which he's generously provided. He's latest is the great tradition of what's come before it is The Leftovers. It's published by St. Martin's, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Tom, welcome.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming back on. I love this book. And for those who aren't familiar with The Leftovers yet, I want to give you a chance to talk about it a little bit and your inspiration for it.
Oh, sure. Well, The Leftovers is that they call the sudden departure. It seems a lot like the Christian rapture, except that it's sort of random. Millions of randomly selected people seem to have disappeared, and no one knows why or where they've gone or anything like that. And so, you know, 3 years after this event, the book kind of explores what this town and this family looks like. And it's kind of a mixed bag. That some people are trying to get on with the lives they had before, and other people have had sort of extreme religious reactions. And there are a bunch of new rapture cults that have sprung up. And so in the family that I'm looking at, the Garvey family, the dad, Kevin, is the mayor of the town, and he's trying to get everything up and running again and saying, look, you know, it really isn't the end of the world. We survived this thing, and let's, you know, get on with our lives. And his wife has just been sort of shattered by her grief. Her best friend lost a daughter, and for some reason this has just broken her, and she's left to join this sort of grassroots cult called the Guilty Remnant that sort of colonized the development on the other side of town, and they dress in white and take a vow of silence and smoke cigarettes and wander the town.
I love that. I love the Guilty Remnant.
Yeah.
So I love the timing of the release of this. I don't know if this was intentional, but, you know, there was this big rapture claim. I can't remember when it was, like a couple of months ago, right?
Yeah. No, so of course my book was done by then. Yeah. When Harold Camping called for the May 21st rapture, I was done with the book, and it was kind of a, you know, serendipitous thing for me. It obviously wasn't a happy thing for people who believed Harold Camping, but, you know, the rapture is one of these concepts that is either extremely familiar to you or not. You know, people who believe it, it's probably the most important fact in the world, and for other people, you know, secular liberal people, it just seems like a you know, eccentric religious footnote. And you know, when I started writing the book, I would explain it to people, and I would get, you know, people would either be fascinated by the concept or sort of baffled by it. And so it really helped me when Harold Camping predicted this rapture on May 21st and the media took the trouble to explain the theology to America. It saved me a lot of trouble.
It's funny because there's always probably some rapture going on someplace or some prediction, right? But you're right. The media really grappled onto this one and ran with it. So.
And yeah, it's very interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think whenever anybody has the chutzpah to say it's, you know, this particular day and I've, you know, cracked the code of the Bible, you know, it's pretty fascinating. And you know, there have been, as you say, a number of these cases. And, you know, there are websites that attempt to, you know, keep a rapture clock, and they sort of, you know, measure the geopolitical events against the prophecies in the Bible and decide whether we're moving toward end times or not. So it's like the old nuclear clock they used to have.
Yeah, right. So this spun out of research or thinking you were doing during The Abstinence Teacher, yeah?
Yes, yeah, so The Abstinence Teacher was a novel about the culture war, and half of the book was devoted to this militant Christian church. And in the course of researching that, I just kept, you know, I guess I really absorbed how thoroughly, you know, people in the evangelical community or some people were, you know, thinking about end times and certain that we were, you know, moving close to the second coming and the rapture and all this. And, you know, I just was, for some reason, you know, taken by it. I think the rapture is just a really poetic apocalypse. You know, we're used to zombies and nuclear war and, you know, viral contagion and whatnot. But, you know, this idea of people just floating away, you know, is poetic and also in some way seems to me like a really good metaphor for what it means to live, you know, and outlive people that you love, and you know, in some poetic sense, you know, we really are left behind. We all are living in a world that's been vacated by people we love, and we just have to keep going.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the interesting observations in this was the concept that some of the people that were being missed were really random people that hadn't been thought about in a long time, and you know, some guy you hadn't seen since preschool, and you know, that rings so true with how people live. You know, that you hear about somebody and you haven't cared about them up until that point, and then you hear they're gone, and you sort of, you know, oddly mourn their loss. And then other people, you know, who were directly affected, you know, some of them obviously were devastated and some not quite as much or not in the same ways. It's, I don't know. It's
yeah,
an interesting commentary.
Well, I think the book is really a kind of, you know, it's about grief on this grand scale. You know, everybody in the book either knew somebody who disappeared or, you know, knew somebody who knew somebody. And I think the phrase in the book is, you know, this mosaic of loss, and you know, every now and then a new piece would get added to it, and I did want to think about, you know, the different ways that we were affected by things like this, and you know, as you say, some of the characters, there's a character Jill who's a teenage girl, and she's considered an eyewitness because she was in the room when one of her friends disappeared, and she seems like oddly unaffected by the loss of this friend, and her psychological reaction is to sort of deny that they were really close and to just claim that she's fine. But in some ways, to the people around her, she's clearly going through a kind of, you know, post-traumatic stress reaction. And you know, her brother Tom is just utterly shattered by the news that this kid that he knew back in elementary school but hasn't seen for years disappeared, and he becomes obsessed with that. And there's a whole movement devoted to these people who become fixated on a particular individual who's gone, who may or may not have been that close to them.
Do you sort of think of this as kind of a post 9/11 novel, you know, that everybody kind of knew somebody or at least knew somebody who knew somebody, and suddenly they were, you know, just gone, and some of them were good people, some of them, you know, some of them had their issues?
Yeah, well, you know, I just want to be careful and say this isn't a book, isn't an allegory of 9/11, but 9/11 is the most recent example of the kind of event that I'm writing about, which is an event that sort of stops history in its tracks. You know, those moments that make us say nothing will ever be the same again. And I think we mean it in the moment that we say it. it. You know, this event, whatever it is, 9/11, you know, a particular war, an assassination, a famine, a hurricane. You know, it kind of fractures the narrative of our lives, and you know, we say, oh, we'll never be the same again. And you know, part of my fascination in this book was, well, 2 or 3 years later, is it true? Even an event like this, like a, you know, a rapture-like event, does it change everything irrevocably, or does it change some things in some ways and other things not at all? And so the town and the family are sort of split between the people who want to say, you know, this event changed our world and is sort of the beginning of a new narrative of our lives, and that our lives need to change entirely. And other people saying, this event interrupted our lives, but we need to resume them. We need to get back to the path that we were on and the way of living that we had before.
Yeah, yeah. My guest this morning is Tom Perotta. The book is The Leftovers. Let's shift a little bit to some crafty questions. The characters in this, obviously, are the driving force behind the novel. And they're all, the thing that always strikes me about your characters is, you know, a lot of characters in books, you say, well, I can relate to them in some way, or I kind of know somebody like this. But all of your characters seem like, not only do I know this person, but I am this person. And your ability to make general characters incredibly specific, but also so incredibly universal. I marvel at it every time. I've marveled at all the books I've read of yours. And I think a lot of that has to come either through telling details or something. Maybe I'll let you reflect on maybe where it comes from. But let's talk a little bit about mining characters, how you come up with character composites, if these people are kind of based on outlines of folks you know in real life, or if you come up with them with, you know, kind of whole cloth, come up with them. Talk a little bit about your process for extracting character.
Yeah, well, I think I'm really happy to hear you say that. And I think one of the choices I made with this book in particular, I think, is and I guess it's something I've done throughout it, is not to make my characters incredibly eccentric. You know, to some extent, I'm writing about very recognizable, middle-of-the-road people. That's not to say they're not, you know, vivid individuals in their own right, because, you know, certainly not, I wouldn't say that people who are, you know, demographically typical are not individuals with individual quirks. But I haven't written about really eccentric people, though people become eccentric, I think, through their expressions of grief or their denial of grief or those sorts of things. But you know, I think the key somehow is to take people in these extreme situations and make their reactions reveal their characters, and often it's fixating on something small. So, like, there's a character in the book, a woman named Nora Durst, and she's probably in the most extreme situation of anyone. She lost her whole family in this rapture-like event. And so it's a real challenge when you're writing to think, like, okay, how do I get at the grief that somebody feels, the bewilderment, the shock in the wake of this? And I really wanted to find some little key that would at least allow me to enter into Nora's world. And in this case, it was she. You know, I have her become obsessed with watching SpongeBob, the show that she watched with her kids, who are gone now. And so our introduction to her for several pages is through this journal she keeps while watching old episodes of SpongeBob. And you know, so that's you know, that was one way to make her sort of familiar and knowable. I think the other way, though, for other characters is just to get them into a relationship where they interact with someone else.
Yeah.
And the book really is consists of a bunch of paired relationships. So, you know, we get to know the characters individually, but we really get to see them in terms of a single relationship. And that's unusual. Usually a novel, I think, is sort of built around, you know, a specific triangle. But this book is made up of, you know, five or six pairs of characters who have a kind of story together throughout the book.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation. I was talking to somebody who was saying that the risk that you fall into is having your main character trying to incite other characters and they become really passive. But yeah, putting them in these pairs forces both people to be, you know, at least acting and reacting and reveal character. That's a great way to go about it.
Especially in a book like this, I think, you know, grief tends to isolate people and make them private. And I think the story is about various people emerging from the isolation that just came from, you know, the way that they got knocked around by their loss.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess Nora would be a good example of that because she really sort of went underground for a number of years, and it would be easy to get your character backed into a corner, I would think, where they kind of never come out of the house, and it's hard to get people to react on them.
Yeah, that's right, and that's where she is when we meet her. Now, I will say, Kevin, the main character, has a number of different relationships, and I guess that's what really makes him the main character of the book. He has a relationship with his daughter, he has a relationship with Nora, he has a sort of place in the town where he's trying to get people to do things. So I think we see him in a, you know, move across a wider field of action. But, you know, Jill has a friend named Amy who's sort of a wild girl who she invites into the house. And you know, Jill's story is basically the story of her friendship with Amy. Tom, their son, drops out of college to follow an eccentric prophet, and he ends up escorting this pregnant 16-year-old girl across the country, and their relationship is at the heart of that one. Lori, the mom who joins the guilty remnant, becomes the trainer of a young woman, and they, even though they take a vow of silence and they're supposed to be sort of cold to one another, they develop this really profound friendship.
Yeah. You're amazing at writing at women's from a woman's point of view as well. Does that come just as naturally to you to write from a woman's point of view as it does from a man's?
Originally, you know, in my first few books, I think I was really considered a male writer, a guy's writer. I wrote about rock bands and, you know, packs of boys growing up. And I think when I got to Election, I realized that if I wanted to get at kind of larger canvas, that I obviously needed to jump in and, you know, not be scared of writing women characters. And I think I learned a lot in doing that book, because I had Tracy and Tammy, and I really, you know, I realized that, you know, the only barriers were, you know, my own fears and hesitations, and sense that, you know, was I qualified or able to do it? And once I put those aside and just, you know, it's like a lot of things in writing, you just claim the authority, and then if you can get away with it, you get away with it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. My guest this morning is Tom Perata. The book is The Leftovers. And something occurred to me as I was reading it. I don't know if it's easier or harder if you have a character who shares your name to put pieces of yourself onto that character, or if you just saw him as a totally different entity. And I don't know. I think if I had a character that shared my name, it would be hard to get the distance. But maybe that helps. I was just curious about your experience with that.
Well, that was almost an experiment. And It came about because after six novels, I've written a lot of characters, and I find it sort of frustrating to search out their names. And one of the reasons I felt that was frustrating was so many names are off limits. You know, you don't want to name a character after your kid. You don't want to name a character after your mom. You don't want to name a character after your best friend or, you know, whoever. There are a lot of names that seem either off limits or fraught with too many associations. And so I just decided that I was going to start reclaiming these off-limits names, and I decided to start with my own. though, you know, I'm sure somebody who, you know, is a trained Freudian would say that that's just a smokescreen and that I wanted to identify with this particular character, and maybe there's some truth in that, too.
I thought, you know, it, or it could be the opposite, that, you know, you... you can kind of distance yourself from them in a way, or just come to see them as a totally different, you know, the anti-you or something. I don't know.
Yeah, well, and of course, you know, I've written, you know, really, like a book like Joe College is, you know, extremely autobiographical, and I was very aware while writing it that I was doing that. So even though the character had a different name, my sense of connection with the character was quite clear. Whereas, I you know, this book takes place in a kind of imaginary future, and you know, the facts of the character's life don't overlap with my own. And so it was, even though he had my name, it was not, I wasn't aware of an intense connection to the character.
Yeah. The other thing that, so two other things really struck me about this. One is balancing backstory and knowing how much of character's backstory needs to get in there, how much until it starts feeling weighted down with, you know, past instead of present, momentum of the present. And maybe we'll start there. Talk a little bit about backstory. When you feel like, you know, whatever is necessary to tell at the back end is informing the front end, or if it's, you know, just kind of entertainment yeah. for you to put it in there.
Well, you know, I think one of the principles I always adhere to when thinking about backstory is not to overload it in the front of the story. I feel like, you know, for the most part, you need to care about the character in the present moment to be interested in his or her backstory. And so I tend to use it more toward the middle of the book. Once you become invested in a character, it can be either to give a new dimension to the character, or it can also be, I think, for pacing purposes sometimes. You know, you want to slow the story down, take a minute to really get to know this character better. You know, I'm thinking of, and you have to think about where you want to deploy whatever information you have. So, for instance, you know, Kevin and Nora begin a sort of bumpy romantic relationship, and you know, before this, right before their, you know, the romance becomes real. Actually, it's right after the romance becomes real. There's a chapter. Where Nora goes through her history of being a girlfriend, and she remembers, you know, a particular college boyfriend that she had, and she remembers, you know, the way that she dealt with her husband before they got married, and she's sort of chastising herself for, you know, not really being able to be a good girlfriend. She's just too weighted down by, you know, the things that have happened to her, and it's a kind of a self-criticism, but it also allows us to see, you know, who Nora was before. You know, life dealt her these cruel blows, and you know, I think if I had put that somewhere else, it you know, just wouldn't. It emerged from the you know, from where the story was. It wasn't like I had this backstory in mind before that. It was more that I was trying to think, well, what's Nora feeling right now, and then it made me dig into her past. So I don't start the book with a sense of the character's past, you know, fully in mind. It's more like the story makes me want to go back into their lives and find the, you know, the anecdotes that illuminate the present.
Yeah. Now, do you write this in a linear way? Because it feels, I mean, it feels so incredibly carefully well-constructed, you know, with the information given when it needs to be given, and like you say, constant attention to when backstory is serving it and when it's getting too much. Do you have, I assume you don't do outlines. This seems like no writers do outlines, but
I don't. And I, you know, I just don't see how you can do it. I definitely write in a mostly linear way, and, you know, I'm trying to always, I do a lot of rereading of what I've written so far, just to get myself into the reader's mind. You know, what do I want to know now? You know, what, you know, you might have written something 6 months ago, and maybe it's 100 pages earlier in the book, but it you'll have dropped a hint in a way about something that you're going to deal with later. And you have to, if you don't reread your book pretty regularly, you might forget that you've planted all kinds of seeds.
Yeah, right.
So that's one way to do it. I mean, in that said, I do occasionally double back and in this case, there was a lot of cutting of scenes early on because I felt like, I think maybe I was trying to convince myself that this premise was real, and so there were a lot of sort of static scenes just kind of insisting that this sudden departure had occurred. And I was able to cut a lot of them. And then there's a prologue about Lori that was added, I think, probably after I'd finished my first draft.
Now, so many of your books have been made into movies. I'm wondering now that there's kind of a wake of movies behind you, if you start to see the, and some of these you've assisted with the screenplay. I'm wondering if you start to see books as movies now that you're kind of straddling that realm.
I don't, you know, and I think it's partly it's because the writing process is such a murky one. You know, I can't really. So for instance, this book, the time frame was really complicated. It's 3 years after the main event, and it takes place more or less over the course of 9 months. But I was well into the book before I realized what the time frame was going to be and how it, you know, what was going to structure it. And you know, I think in movies in particular, a complicated time frame like that is difficult to handle.
Yeah, right.
And an extended time frame like that.
Right.
It's a very episodic novel. And so I think it would just have been really counterproductive and difficult to try and imagine a movie version of this before I had the actual book version.
I hope somebody does.
Yeah. Well, I it's been optioned by HBO, and so we're trying to think about making it into a series, which I like the idea of because it can really breathe and you're not compressing and you know, cutting and all that.
Yeah, you'd have plenty of time for everybody's history, and yeah, that would be.
It seems like a really novelistic form, you know, the long form TV.
Yeah, it does. It does. That'd be great. Sadly, we're drawing down on our time. Do you have advice for writers that we haven't covered so far? Anything that pops to your mind that we haven't covered?
I don't. I'm not a fountain of advice. I mean, I probably have some advice if somebody had a specific question, but free floating.
You've given us a lot. You've given us a lot.
Yeah.
So this is all good. You've given us a lot of great reading material and a great thinking material. So this is fantastic, Tom. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me again.
Thank you. That was sure. Tom Perata. The book is The Leftovers. It's published by St. Martin's and out in hardcover now. It's really a fun read. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Jane Mendelson will be here for the second half hour with American Music. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Weekly Signals, the only weekly news commentary radio broadcast that features a dog named Mahler. Weekly Signals with Nathan Callahan and Mike Kaspar. News with a bite. Friday mornings at 8 here on KUCI 88.9 FM. Radio that keeps on giving.
Why do you linger here when there is no hope?
There is still hope.
Tempted to think there's no hope for overcoming some of the challenges of modern life? Ask an elf.
Or a hobbit.
Tune in Tuesdays, 4 to 5 p.m. with Milo Lomsdown at your service and...
Tawny Tenuvial, the resident KUCI Middle Earth Elf.
For What Would Arwen Do? On KUCI Irvine, 88.9 FM, and streaming live on KUCI.org.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit iTunes. We are under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and I'm joined now by Jane Mendelson. Jane is a graduate of Yale University. She is the author of two previous novels, including the New York Times bestseller, I Was Amelia Earhart. Her articles and reviews have appeared in The Village Voice, The Yale Review, The London Review of Books, and The Guardian. Her latest novel is American Music. It's emotionally and narratively complex. It pays very strong dividends. It's my pleasure to welcome her this morning. Jane, hi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. This was a treat. This is such a great novel. I want to give you a chance for folks who haven't seen it yet. It is now out in paperback, but I want to give you a chance to talk about it and your inspiration for writing it.
Well, the inspiration came from sort of two different threads wove together. My first bit of inspiration came when I heard a story from a friend who does body work, and she told me about a client she once had who wouldn't lie on his back. And I started just imagining who that person would be and came up with the idea of a soldier and who had a secret, why he wouldn't. And then the other nugget was when some people I know told me that there was a secret formula for making symbols with a C in a drum set, that dated back centuries and was still the main formula being used today to make the biggest, the main symbols that are used in the world, the Zildjian company symbols. And I thought that was really interesting that there was a secret formula. I was kind of taken with the pun, which doesn't really come up in the book. I mean, symbols with a C and symbols with an S, and that there would be somebody searching for a secret formula or that a secret formula would even exist for making that. So those two things wove together over many years, actually, to create this book about a soldier with post-traumatic stress disorder and who has these visions that kind of contain the whole 20th century.
Yeah. Yeah, it's such a... I was talking about this in the first half hour with Tom Perotta, how American these novels are, how quintessentially American they are, and how we haven't had a lot of American novels come out in the last little bit, and it kind of... This is a nice refreshing change.
Maybe it's the sort of end of the empire feeling.
Yeah.
We're trying to kind of sum up or figure out what's gone on, and...
Yeah.
I definitely think I was feeling a kind of what happened that got us here.
Right. Now, you wrote this over the course of like 10 years, yeah?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And a lot happened in those 10 years.
Well, a lot happened. I started writing it. I live in New York City, and I started writing it really during the time I wrote it, I had two young kids, two babies who are now not so young. And so I was very busy with them. And also during that time, there was 9/11, and then there was the whole kind of crazy boom years. And so sort of against the backdrop of all of that, I was trying to figure out, you know, what had gone on, what was kind of the trajectory of this past century, how it could be viewed through everyday lives.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah. I'm curious, you know, as you live through the past 10 years, I mean, you as a person have to change quite a bit, right? And so trying to keep a cohesive voice and a cohesive narrative string through a really compressed book strikes me as something that would be hard, that you'd finish it at the end of the 10 years and say, well, you know, whatever I wrote 10 years ago isn't the same person that I am now. And so tell me a little bit about trying to keep the integrity of the voice and the novel going over that period of time.
That's a really interesting question. Thank you for asking it. It's just the kind of question I love to think about. You know, I did. There's always a final push with a book where I kind of go over the whole thing and make sense of. I'm trying to figure it out while I'm writing, and then there's a push of intense revision at the end where I kind of say, okay, this is what I was trying to say. Oh wow, and this is how I've been trying to say it, and then I go and kind of make the whole thing work.
Yeah.
Having finally understood, I think the whole process of writing the book is kind of a way of figuring all that out. It's almost like rehearsing, and then, in a way, my favorite part is that last push of the writing. It's like you finally go out and perform your dance routine or your, you know, whatever it is you've been practicing all that time, and you can kind of be in the moment knowing it completely, and that's where I think figure out the whole voice.
That's really well put. I heard your father is a psychologist, yeah?
Yeah, he's a psychiatrist.
Oh, psychiatrist, yeah.
Yes.
I wonder if, how much that lingers in the back of whatever the background was of growing up in a sort of, you know, reflective household, how much that's influenced your writing and influenced these stories and kind of your thinking on human psychology.
I think that's also a really great question. Hugely. I grew up in an atmosphere of that kind of thought. There are other psychiatrists in my family too. And then on the flip side, or not the flip side, but as a complement to that, my mother is an art historian, and I feel like it's such a combination that leads to a novelist, sort of the psychology plus the art. And I think particularly the psychology was very important to me with this book. It's, you know, ends up being about generations and how they influence each other, and really a lot about human beings over time and their psychology. And I don't like to spell things out, so
right.
I think it can be hard to see. But I was very, very concerned that the psychology and the inner workings of these characters make a kind of emotional, psychological sense.
Right, right. You had a great observation that I wanted to share with our listeners, and that was that similarly, kind of the analogy of this woman drawing out this man's stories and having her hands on his body and these stories bubbling up is similar to the writer having her hands on kind of the reader's mind and eyes and how the writer's job is to release the reader's experiences and stories so that they too can kind of participate in the novel through their own memories.
Yes.
Talk about that a little bit. I assume that comes out through telling details. I assume it comes out through tapping into, you know, specifics that tap into the universal. But tell me a little bit more about that idea and how you try and implement it.
Well, I think I'm very interested in process, and I feel like the process of reading a book, the experience of reading a book, is writing it and reading it is always really very present for me, and I'm always thinking about the reader's experience and how I can transmit to them and what it feels like to read a book and kind of give, more than anything else, even more than a story, I'm trying to give an experience and to share the experience I'm having writing it. I feel like that's one of the most powerful things that gets transmitted from writer to reader through the book. The book is like this vessel for that.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of did think of her hands on his body that way. I also thought of her hands on his body like the reader's hands on the book. The writer's hands writing the book, the reader's hands on the physical book or the page or whatever, the screen, the Kindle, however it is the reader's reading it, kind of absorbing and transmitting this. It's such an almost mystical process. How I hope to get that across is, I think, by giving just enough information, but leaving things out.
Yeah.
Also, so that the reader is an active participant, and so that can sometimes, you know, there's a little bit of work involved, but I feel like it's a great, pleasurable, sort of exquisite sort of work to do. So I don't like to spell things out for just that reason. I think that's the biggest part of where the reader's experience and sort of meeting of the minds happens.
That is such a talent, is knowing where the white space should go and knowing, you know, how much information to give that's enough to kind of tickle the nerves mm-hmm. of the imagination, and then how much is overwriting. I think new writers especially probably tend to overwrite and overexplain, and, you know, I don't think you're going to get it, so I'm just going to keep pounding you over the head with,
right,
this is what I'm trying to tell you. And is yeah. that, I assume that comes through experience and kind of knowing what works. Does it, do
yeah.
you all, yeah?
It does it what? I'm sorry.
And I was also going to say, I don't know if you have readers for the work that kind of tell you, you know, kind of give you an insight into how much is enough. But
I do have some people who I show my work to along the way, who I get a sense of that from. I do think it comes from experience. I think it's also a matter of personal style a little bit. So I've never been somebody who sort of was drawn to spell everything out anyway. So that's just kind of naturally. I also think it comes from getting back to your really interesting question about psychology and my family background. That's also very much part of the skill of a good psychiatrist
yeah.
would be to know how to say just enough but not too much, and to draw out the other person and get them to really have their own insights.
Yeah, right. My guest this morning is Jane Mendelsohn. The book is American Music. And the other thing that strikes me about this is structure and how hard that would be. When to give the stories, when to move into the past, when to come back to the present. Tell me, and hand in hand with that, writing it over the course of the 10 years and trying to keep the forest from the trees sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. That is very tough. That's another process question that is really interesting and just happens for me kind of slowly over time, piecing it together and figuring out what works. But the structure, once I landed on the idea that, okay, because it wasn't immediate that all of these stories were coming from him and that they were all connected, once I figured out how they were connected and that I was definitely going to use this idea of they're coming from him, because to begin with, I had my hesitations about that. I mean, I did not mean for it to be taken literally. It's not, you know, and I hesitated right from the start about, are people going to think this is really cheesy or, you know, what? And then I decided that's the way I'm telling the story. That's how it, you know, it's. I don't think of it literally, and that's just what I'm going to do. So once I overcame that, piecing it all together and having the stories make sense is a lot of instinct. A certain amount of showing it to the few people who, as I said, I mean, there's my husband is my first reader. That my editor is an amazing, amazing person, Ann Close at Knopf, and I do show things to her. And just that kind of instinct of, okay, what can I put here? And then the juxtapositions of the stories and the time periods, there's almost a musical rhythmic instinct behind it all as well.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, this would be a great time, if you don't mind, to read to us, because mm-hmm. I have a question on voice, and it would be great to have our listeners be able to hear the voice of the novel before we tackle
that. Sure, I'll read the first few pages.
Perfect. I'm speaking with Jane Mendelsohn. The book is American Music, and yeah, go.
Chapter 1, 2005. She stands up in the subway car where she has been sitting and looks out into the darkness. Her stop is coming, and she likes the moment before the light breaks through the window. There is her reflection in the glass, a ghost with a shifting skeleton and a visible heartbeat as the columns and dim lights that make up the architecture of this underworld scroll through her body rapid fire in the blackness. Then she disappears into the light. She turns toward the doors. She adjusts the strap of the bag slung across her chest and quickly steps onto the platform. It is raining softly when she emerges onto the street. From a distance, she appears to be marching silently through the mist. With her steady gaze and long coat, her faded satchel and heavy boots, she looks both present and ancient. She looks like some beautiful soldier arrived from history. She walks several blocks along empty gray streets toward a large, white, undistinguished building. In the lobby of the building, she shows an identification card and rides up in the elevator. She steps off and walks down a hall. A door is open for her. Inside, a man is lying chest down on a table, a thin white sheet covering his body. His hand lifts lightly when she enters. "You're here," she says. "I'm here," he says. "That's something," she says. "It is." Every week, she pulls down the sheet and studies his back. She washes her hands and oils them and then rubs the oil onto the skin. His hands clench when she starts to work. He seems to be experiencing something more than pain. As she touches him, there is transmitted to her bones his fierce desire to remain separate. He is determined not to reveal his secrets. She has visited him for weeks, and she knows his back by now, the flat plane between the shoulder blades, the slope down to the sacrum. But she knows only his back, his neck, his arms, his legs. He will only lie on his front. He will never lie on his back, never let her work on his chest or face. He will not tell her why. She knows only that he has seen more than he can share, and she was told during the interview that she would have to respect his privacy. "These men are suffering," the nurse had cautioned her. "These men are haunted." Still, there were stories in his body that she searched for like a detective. She had begun to feel as though she could read him, as if she could interpret the meaning in his knots and sinews. Sometimes, and this was not the first time she had questioned her sanity, she received visions from his limbs, his muscles, his bones. The first time it had happened, she was touching his ankle when there arose in her mind the image of a woman standing underwater in a shaft of light, her dark hair wafting weightlessly like ink. Then her hand reached his neck and she saw more people. At first they appeared to be moving to music, glittering couples swaying on a dance floor. But then in a shift of perspective, she saw hundreds of bodies, each alone, swaying upright underwater, an underwater graveyard with thousands of unseeing eyes staring directly at her. Suddenly she felt sick. The light changed outside, the sky grew darker, and in the small, dim room, the body on the table seemed to break beneath her touch. Then, from inside that, as if it were a hollowed-out, broken sculpture, came pouring waves of water. She placed her hands on the man's back until she could not see the swaying bodies any longer. She took a breath. For the moment, there were no more visions. She was safe. Yet within him, she knew, were only more stories, for a soldier's body is a work of art that contains his country's history. "You were saying something in your sleep," she said. "No, stop there."
So great. That was Jane Mendelsohn reading from American Music. There's so much in these first couple of pages that I want to talk about in exactly 3 minutes.
Okay,
that's
great.
Obviously not going to happen. But yeah, I mean, first of all, your ability to start right in the center of action and, you know, not give, you know, so many novels, you know, we have the weather and we're going on.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So that and how much the first couple of pages tell about the rest of the novel, I think, is amazing. Every single word is chosen so incredibly carefully. So I guess one of my questions is about whether you I assume you study a lot of poetry, because it just feels like the compression of language here is really impressive.
Yes, I started out writing poetry. I wrote poetry. I started really writing at the end of high school. I mean, I'd always written little stories and things, but I really got excited about being a writer, thinking of myself as writing. At the end of high school, when I started seriously reading poetry and getting it, and I love John Ashbery, whose style is very different from mine, certainly, but he's one of my favorite contemporary poets. And so I do. I think a lot about every word. I think a lot about all the layers of every word, every sentence. So it's slow going, but I hope kind of, you know, meaningful.
Yeah.
And I do like it when the beginning of something kind of encapsulates everything that's ahead, and then you can look back on it later and think, "Oh, okay, I see. Everything was really planted."
Right.
In an organic way, not manipulative, but that it was all there.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, I really marvel at those first couple of pages and endings too. I think beginnings and endings, and you know, how to jump into the story, and then mm-hmm. when you know things have resonated and circled back and, you know, closed themselves, I think is really nice. Was that where a lot of your time was spent, with sort of beginnings and endings, or was it just kind of was it all difficult?
That's a really good question. I think thinking about the beginning is huge, and writing the beginning was something I worked on very much. I knew I wanted to start with her. She's really the Honor is the character's name, and she's really the sort of through line of the book, and him, their relationship. And then the end, that took a lot, too, because, you know, with the end, you always have some really major decisions to make, and you want to hit the right note and the right tone, and that takes a lot of work, too. So I would say that, yes, beginnings and endings are a lot of it, although getting the rhythm right in between is a big deal as well.
Yeah.
It's all
a big deal.
You have to love the process. That's what I do. So I can't imagine working through it unless it was a real pleasure.
Yeah, right. I could talk to you for another hour and a half, but
I would love
were
to.
There, me too. Were there are there things of advice for writers that we haven't covered? Anything else that's big that we've left out?
Let's see. Loving the process and trusting, you know, your own voice. I mean, an interesting quick story going back to the fact that I love John Ashbery so much is I did end up reviewing some of his work early on in my writing life, and then I met him, and one of the most astounding things that happened when I met him was I realized, oh, wow, he's so amazing, he's so brilliant, and I'm so completely different that I have to go write my own way.
Yeah.
And so that's the other piece of advice I would give. I know it sounds obvious, but you keep rediscovering it.
Yeah, no, I think a lot of writers fall into that trap where you start reading people you love, and then you start, maybe the first form of that is trying to imitate them, but then, yeah, you realize you just have to kind of, you have your own voice,
yes,
and you've got to go with it.
Right, that's a turning point. I think you do start imitating other things, and then a big turning point is when you find your own.
Yeah, yeah. Gina, this was such a huge pleasure for me. Thanks so much.
Thank you, too. Pleasure for me, too.
That was Jane Mendelsohn. The book is American Music. It is out now in paperback, published by Vintage, and totally pleasure. That's all the time we have for today. I'll be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. Actually, I think Barbara will be back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.
Walk away from me.